Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2011. Lecture 2, delivered on January 13, 2011. The title of this lecture is Financial Markets and Interest Rates.
Today, financial markets and interest rates. Financial markets and interest rates. This lecture covers a bit of ground, but it's all essentially for the first couple of weeks. There's a lot of foundational kind of stuff in here. Basic concepts, really important definitions and ideas, and then we get down to some of the more brass tacks of financial calculations. I even do a chapter on accounting, which I guess I have to, but along the way I'll also be quickly touching on some other important things too. On Tuesday, I am of a mind that I will do the Federal Reserve on Tuesday, because today I'm going to talk about interest rates in more of an abstract way, and then it would be good for next week to get the how interest rates are actually forming out there in the real world, and with the political dynamics behind interest rate movements as it is happening right now, which is an important and interesting period. But let me get started here with some basic ideas. Now, could you lend me $100?
No.
Boy, you said that fast. Well, the heck with you. You see, when we talk about money being borrowed, money being lent, no, not loaned, lent. When we talk about money, oh, there comes the projector on, for God's sake. Bear with me. Okay. I can divide the world into those who need money and those who have money. And it's not as easy, it's not a simple thing. But essentially, if you need money, and I'll be more specific about what I mean by money in a while. But if you need money, we would call you a deficit economic unit. Now, when I say you, that could be you personally, you as a business, you as a state, you as the federal government. But if you are seeking money, you are a deficit economic unit. On the other hand, if you have money that's available to lend, you would be called a surplus economic unit. A surplus economic unit. Now, here's the odd thing, though, is that you could be, and again, that you, remember, I'm talking about you as a person, a business, or a sovereign entity of some kind. You could be both a surplus and a deficit economic unit at the same time. I am looking at you. I'll bet you're a filthy rich person. Because hell no. But even if you were a very wealthy person, you might not have the money for a cheeseburger. And we need cheeseburgers in this life. We need food. So in one sense, you could be a surplus unit. You have money that is available that could be lent, but at the same time, you need money for that burger. And so we have this odd situation where you could be a borrower and a lender at the same time. Matter of fact, most of you will be very soon in your productive lives, because money will be taken out of your bank accounts for retirement. That money will go into a pool that will be available to lend. So in that regard, you would participate in a large surplus economic unit. But at the same time, you might have to borrow for that double-wide trailer you're dreaming of having. Goes with the double-wide wife. Yes, it does. Living the dream. But you see, there you go. That the world is very complex in terms of finance, that we could be borrowers and lenders at the same time, surplus economic units and deficit economic units at the same time. This hints at and gives us motivation to probe more into what I mean by money. Money. We talk about that all the time. Do you like money?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
It's cool. I mean, it works for me. Yeah, I make friends with money. You know, I have friends with it. But you see, the thing is that we have to talk about money in a more specific way. Money has dimension to it. Money has dimension. The first important thing about money is the liquidity of it. Liquidity. Liquidity is the ease with which an asset can be converted into another asset. Liquidity is the ease with which an asset can be converted into another asset. Therefore, a house could be of great value but have very low liquidity. On the other hand, I've got a couple of George Washingtons in my wallet, I think. Yeah, here we go. Here's one of them. I got a couple of these. See these things? These are highly liquid assets. Matter of fact, they are the most liquid of the assets around. Are these greenbacks right here. They're the most liquid of the assets. From here, it goes downhill. The liquidity is related to the quality of the asset and its recognizability as a liquid asset. So in other words, money is money if everyone agrees that it's money, or if other people agree that it's money. I could be money if you thought I was money. You see, whatever we have in an economy that is widely recognized as being money, well, that's money. But liquidity is the first of the dimensions, the liquidity of it. Okay? So, and also, there are other dimensions too, but let me focus on the liquidity. And also the durability. So, I will divide money into money that is short term and money that is longer term. In other words, I'm going to run money along an axis of time. Now, let me do it this way. Short term money is available in money markets. Now, by short term, I would say a year or less. We call the money that is available in markets where the borrowing and lending occurs, or the availability, I should say, is for periods of a year or less. We call that kind of money, those markets, money markets. When the borrowing and lending or the availability is for longer than a year, we say that the money is in a capital market, a capital market. Now, there will be a couple of times in this course where I'm going to touch on on what are really business law subjects. Now, have you had a business law course here yet? You have? Well, you didn't have it for me, so it probably wasn't as good. But I will definitely have to touch on contract law in this class. I'll definitely have to hit contract law. And here's where I'll touch on it just lightly, just for a little bit here. Look, when you borrow or lend, you are entering into a contract. As a borrower, you are the issuer of debt. As a borrower, you are the issuer of debt instrument. You are the one who is issuing a debt instrument. You say, well, wait a minute, I borrowed money, I didn't write the contract, but you did. Someone else put it together, but it comes from you. You are the issuer of the debt instrument as the borrower. And if someone buys that debt instrument at an agreed upon price, that person is the purchaser of your debt instrument. The purchase price is the amount lent. The purchase price is the amount lent. So this is kind of different from how you would think of it and how common people think of borrowing and lending. But really, when you borrow money, you are issuing a debt instrument. When you lend money, you are the purchaser of some borrower's debt instrument. So if I want to borrow some money, I will put forth a contract and say to you, madam, I am offering for sale this debt instrument. And you would say, okay, I shall purchase that debt instrument from you. And in so purchasing, the money you pay me for it is the amount you lend me. And the contract has the terms and conditions under which I repay you. Okay, can you follow that idea? And I will do this over and over. This is kind of one of those little tiny crucial points. You're the issuer when you borrow. You are the buyer when you lend. We move on. Okay, so now we have the money markets and the capital markets. Now in the money markets, personal finance, you probably say in the money markets the most common kinds of borrowing would be like on little promissory notes, IOUs, maybe at one of those quickie cash places. Those would be money markets for people, individuals. Now, in the world of business, short-term lending, the kinds of instruments you would hear talked about would be certificates of deposit. Negotiable certificates of deposit could be less than a year in length. A big, big market is what's called commercial paper. Commercial paper is very short-term borrowing by very credit-worthy corporations. Commercial paper is big, big stuff. Very short-term. And it's very high quality. In other words, it has high liquidity, very high quality stuff. Interestingly, though, there have been a couple of examples of commercial paper that was pumped out by companies that were about to die. If I'm not mistaken, Enron was pushing commercial paper right before it went tap city. So it's not always as good as you might think. But in general, commercial paper, a company, a very creditworthy, very big company might say, well, we need $50 million for 30 days. So we're going to issue $50 million worth of commercial paper. That would be a short-term money market kind of instrument. Now, in the capital markets, you get all kinds of animals, bonds, stock markets, those kinds of things in the capital markets. Bonds and notes are out there in the capital markets and other things. And I'll get into that in a minute. But here's the thing. The world has economic units that are surplus And it has economic units that are deficits at any given point in time. And as I pointed out, you could at once be a surplus unit and a deficit economic unit. At different times, you could be a major surplus unit, and at other times, a major deficit economic unit. Interestingly enough, the United States was a surplus economic unit for a couple of years at the end of the 1990s, and then it turned into a big deficit economic unit, getting worse and worse every year, even to now. But there has to be a way for a surplus unit and an economic unit, a deficit economic unit, to get together. Now, it's not going to happen on a matchmaking site. It's not going to happen on Facebook. It has to happen with some specialized kind of entity that is in the business of putting surplus and deficit economic units together. We call those specialized entities financial intermediaries. Financial intermediaries. Financial intermediation is putting together surplus economic units with deficit economic units. That's financial intermediation. And the animals are all across the board, from investment houses to banks to savings and loans to the government. All kinds of financial intermediaries are out there. But know this. It's not just a matter of putting together a surplus economic unit with a deficit economic unit. It has three dimensions. In order for two units on opposite sides to come together, they must match in terms of one, size of the amount of money needed, two, timing of the money needed, and three, riskiness of the money needed. Size or level, timing and risk. So in other words, I might have $100. I'd lend it for a couple of weeks, but you need, your business needs $1 million for 5 years. I can't help you. The financial intermediation would not work. We don't match. You have to find an opposite unit, a surplus unit, that has the profile of having that much money, willing to lend it for that period of time, and willing to bear the risk that you are presenting in your business prospect. I can't do it. I just don't have the money, I don't have the time, and I probably really don't want the risk, because you look like a risky SOB if ever I saw one. Okay? Is this like a poltergeist that keeps turning that son of a... There. It'll stay off. Okay. But there you are. This is an enormous ocean that's happening all around us all the time. This financial intermediation, to the tune not of millions of dollars in the globe on any given day, not even billions, possibly trillions are flowing back and forth between those who need it and those who have it, provided the service of matching them, provided by financial intermediaries of one kind or another. It's just enormous how much happens under the surface that the common person just doesn't know is happening. All of this money that is flowing, that's keeping the world alive. And really it is. And I'll tell you just a side little story here about how crucial that is. There was a day in September of 2008 Now, here's how the story goes to the best of our understanding. At sometime around 10 o'clock Eastern Time in the United States, some numbers jockeys watching screens at the Federal Reserve, the Central Bank of the United States, started noticing an abnormal amount of money being withdrawn from money market accounts in the United States. Not just abnormal, very large. You know, it was one of the things, well, that's kind of weird. But it wasn't just one-time, one-trick pony. It showed up again and again, more and more large, in the billions of dollars being pulled from the money markets, one after the other. Couple of billion, 1 minute, 10 minutes later, another couple, then 10 billion hits, then more $10 billion hits. By the time you get to about noon, there was literally a sense of this can't keep going. If this keeps going, by maybe 2 o'clock, these banks are going to collapse. The entire financial system is going to just shut down. They don't have what is being withdrawn. And if we shut down, if we collapsed, as a clock worked its way west around the world, the entire world's economy would have turned off that fast. From what I've been told by people who are very sober, it was almost like watching apocalypse happening right in front of their eyes. The Federal Reserve shut down the ability of anyone to pull money out of money markets. I believe they did it at about noon. They then went to Congress. They first informed the president, then they went to Congress and they said, this is not normal. This is really, really bad. We are on the verge of something terrible. Now, there are some conservative, kind of perhaps a little bit loopy, congressmen like Jeff Sessions, who claimed that the House Speaker at the time, Nancy Pelosi, put the House of Representatives under martial law. And essentially, you can't leave until we figure out what we're going to do about this crisis that's happening. You heard out in the normal world about, well, there was this financial crisis and all these bubbles and all this kind of stuff. That's not even a tiny part of how serious it was. The Fed people who were testifying before Congress that day and the Treasury Secretary, they were scared. They were really scared. You're talking about money on the levels of trillions of dollars that were essentially just vanishing from the system. That's the weird part. When money goes out one place, it should show up someplace else. That wasn't really, they couldn't find where the money was going. It was just being pulled. And that's one of the parts that was really scary, is that essentially the guts of a financial system that lives by the flows of capital had to be shut down in one of its major aspects, the money markets, simply because we couldn't let that bleeding keep going. One way or the other, we were going to have to turn off the system or it was going to turn itself off. If we turned it off, we could then figure out what the hell to do about it. And as much criticism as even I would give to the people at the time, at least we avoided a total meltdown of the global financial system, which very well could have happened that day. Very well. And if it had happened, it would have been something like you wouldn't believe. Paychecks would no longer have been accessible. Businesses would have had to turn off their lights because they couldn't pay their bills. It would have been awesome. So that gives you an idea. I mean, for me, I'm ready for the zombie apocalypse. I have no problem. I watch Zombieland. And if you didn't, you're in trouble. If you did, don't forget the double tap, for God's sake. Ugh. Now that should concern you a little bit. You see, our system, it is a global system. It is phenomenal in its global reach. It's phenomenal in its size. Just the staggering amount of money that's flowing every day. But it's also phenomenal in its fragility. I wouldn't have even been able. I was predicting a very serious economic crisis before it happened. But even I couldn't have imagined how fragile that system really was. That something could have caused a global meltdown that fast. So there you are. Huge, unbelievably powerful, but also fragile as hell. And let us hope that we don't have to deal with that again, because I don't want to have to shoot you for food. Now, in the world of debt instruments, the division between money market and capital market is not quite what we use. In terms of borrowing, any instrument of debt that is a year or less, some say less than a year, but I say a year or less, we call a bill. A bill. If I give you an IOU that I'll pay back in 3 months, I'm issuing a bill. Now, it's interesting in our common language. Well, I got a bill in the mail. No, you issued a bill and it's come back to you in the mail. Now, think about that. You have to be careful in that thinking. You get a bill in the mail. That's what people would say. I got a bill in the mail. But actually, since you are the one who has to pay it, you were the one who issued it. Why is it a bill? Because it's due in less than a year. You see, when you get an electric bill, what you were doing was having an electric company lend you money so that you could have electricity. And now they are sending you a statement representing the amount of the bill you issued as you turned on your lights and turned off your lights every time you did during the period. You have to work on that for a while sometimes, but that's literally what's going on. You don't get bills in the mail. All you're doing is getting back the bill that you issued in some way, shape, or form. In fact, what you get in the mail really is evidence of the bill. It's some statement about the bill. The bill is what you issued. What they're sending you is what you owe on what you issued. But it's a bill because it's due in less than a year. That's why we've always called them bills, is because they're due in less than a year. Now, between a year and... Okay, I'm going to put my neck out. 7 years. Between a year and 7 years, debt instruments that are due in that time frame we call notes. Notes. So when you borrow money for a car, it's usually on something like a 4 to 6 year time period. You are the issuer of a note. You borrowed, you issued. And so the bank was the purchaser of your note. The bank that lent you the money, what it was doing was buying your note at the price you requested to buy the car. It wasn't such a good car. I've seen your car. It's ugly. But no, that's what a note is. Now, a bond is any instrument that's longer than 7. A bond is any instrument that's longer than 7. So when you borrow money to buy a house, that would almost always be you are issuing a bond. James Bond. No, sorry. My jokes just fall flat. What the hell is wrong with people anymore? The hell with you? I'll go back to the stand-up comedy circuit. Get disrespect the old-fashioned way. Okay. but it's a bond. And corporations, most likely you would think of when a corporation borrows money, it issues bonds because it will pay it back over a long period of time. Understand this, that consumer bonds and corporate bonds, corporate and government bonds, are quite different animals. A consumer bond is very different from a corporate or a government bond. Here's why, and I'm going to write some things down. I'll turn on this projector for a minute here and write some things down. But here's why in a nutshell. When you borrow money for a house, you make payments, and we're actually on this course, you'll learn how to make the do the calculations, see what your payment will be. We'll talk about affordability and all that. But you make payments, and those payments pay the interest on the amount outstanding, and they also pay off a little bit of the principal. In other words, you are with a consumer bond, the payments service the debt and amortize the principal both. Consumer bonds, the payment with consumer bonds, the payments are calculated so that they service the debt, in other words, pay the interest that's accumulated for the period on the outstanding amount, and they amortize some of what you owe. So every payment you make carves down what you still owe a little bit. At the beginning of the life of one of these 30-year fixed-rate mortgages, I mean, you're paying off a dollar or two on hundreds of thousands, maybe. But as time goes along, more and more of that payment is amortizing and less of it is required to service because the amount outstanding is going down. With corporate and government bonds, there is no amortization going on during the life of the instrument. It's all just the interest payment. At the end of the life of the bond, the principal, the original amount, is paid off along with the last interest payment. That makes them very different animals from what you are used to. Let me show you how we think about a bond. Now, we usually carve up corporate and government bonds into $1,000 units. Every corporate bond, unless I say differently, would have a face value or face of $1,000. That is how much you will pay as a corporation at the end. That's the face. Now, the corporate and government bonds will also describe a year. That's how long the bond will be outstanding. The maturity. It will be stated, for example, 2031. So in other words, there are 20 years on the life of this bond. 2026, that would be a 25-year bond. Is there, I turn it off, what do I have to do, shoot the damn thing? And then the other thing that you will have also is the coupon rate. It will be a percentage. That percentage will be how much interest is owed on $1,000 as a percentage. So I could, for example, write 8.5 MFST 41. That would be a bond. Every year, that bond would, if you bought that bond, if you were the lender to Microsoft. Every year in the mail, you would get a check for $85. Why 85? 8.5% of 1,000. Actually, in the real world, and I'll get back to this in a few lectures from now, you would get $42.50 every 6 months. Typically, they pay them semi-annually, the coupon. But you would get this $85 check in the mail every year from now until the end of 2041. And at the end of 2041, you would get one last $85 check, and you would get a check for $1,000. The face would be paid off. That's how bonds work. The listing here tells you all about the instrument. Now, you do have to, I'll be more detailed about this in future lectures. We'll price bonds, we'll find out yields on bonds, and all of that. But this is what I want you to know for now about a bond. There are a couple of other things. If you look in a newspaper, you'll see little symbols beside them. Sometimes companies issue bonds that are callable. You see this 8.5% right here? That is a representation by the company issuing the bond. Well, we think the risk of this bond is commensurate with about 8.5% return to an investor. Well, what if the prevailing interest rate environment fell to 5% on a risk-adjusted basis? This company would like to get rid of it because it's paying too much interest. It would like to refi. If the bond is callable, it could do that. That would be adverse to the investors. It really would be adverse to the investors. The investors would say, bite me. But it can be done. You see, with home mortgage loans, usually they are callable. If you borrow money on a home mortgage, you can probably, at least in the future, maybe pay some penalties. You can pay it off and refinance at a lower rate. A lot of people did it when interest rates dropped through the floor. People who had loans at like 8, 9, 10%, they refied down at 4.5% and things like that. So that would be adverse to you as an investor. So be careful when you're looking at bonds. Is it callable? There's another nasty one called convertible. A company that issues convertible bonds, if it's convertible, the company could actually turn it into stock, which sucks. You know, the company can't pay its bills. How can it? What good would it be as a stock investment? Now I'm going to take you on a little exercise. There's a very special kind of debt instrument that's issued by the United States government. There are variations on this out in the non-sovereign world. Certainly zero coupon bonds are an example of this. But in terms of government debt instruments, there's an animal called a discount bill. A discount bill. It's a special instrument. It's a little unusual, and I'll show you an example in a minute. But what is cool about this instrument, aside from the fact that Treasury bills, as they're called, T-bills, are extraordinarily liquid. They're virtually as liquid as dollar bills. As a matter of fact, the Federal Reserve uses them and dollar bills in concert to control the money supply. T-bills are that liquid. But these T-bills have a very special feature, and that feature allows us a window on one of the most important first principles in all of finance. So here I'm going to show you a T-bill, how it works, and then bring up for you, or see if you can catch, that essential first principle. Now, a T-bill works like this. The government promises to pay you back $1,000 in 1 year. It promises $1,000. And you will lend the government a certain amount of money now to get back $1,000 in 1 year. You will lend them something like $950. And then in a year, you'll get a check for $1,000. So let's go to a T-bill auction. Now, in the old days, they actually were table auctions. I guess that now it's all electronic. And we're going to go to an auction of T-bills, these short-term borrowings, bills because they're short. Now remember, you're going to get $1,000 back in 1 year. And so we're going to go, you go to the auction. You're going to borrow, you're thinking of lending the government money. And you're walking around the tables, kicking the tires of the T-bills. $1,000 in the back in a year. So you finally, this one's a kind of an attractive one. So you decide you're going to buy that one. So you pick it up from the table and you take it over to me. I'm the cashier. I'm Mabel. Oh, well, how are you doing there, young man? Aren't you a very attractive young? My God, you're a stud. Hey, you want one of these nice tea bills? Well, that's good. We've got a lot of them here. We got a lot of people looking for them, offering prices. So they're going to be kind of expensive today. We're looking at, hey, Phil, how much are tea bills going for? Check on aisle 3. They're going for $980 today. Okay, that'll be $980. Would you like that in a bag? Phil, I need bags! There you go. There's your T-bill. Good boy. In 1 year, you'll get $1,000. Right, in the mail. Have a nice day. Now let's look at what happened. Don't ever go to a T-bill auction and say, teacher said there'd be a lady named Mabel here. Okay. Price, face, dollar interest, and yield. What was the price we worked out? $980. Now, what's the face on this? $1,000. Unless I say differently, it will always be $1,000. I won't even tell you in a problem on a quiz or an exam. You will assume, unless I say differently, that the face is $1,000. So now tell me, when you get your money back at the end of the year, how many dollars in interest did you earn? Dollars. You lent $980, you got $1,000, so what did you get? $20. Now here's the part, for God's sake, be careful to get the yield. I got back $20. How much did I lend? Don't put $1,000 down there. That just singes the fringe on my boxers. Too much information, teacher. By the way, I will put that as, if you make the mistake of putting $1,000, that will be a multiple choice answer. The wrong answer. Yes, I am an asshole. Now work it out. 20 divided by 980 comes out to be, what does it come out to be? Well, say that again, 2.04. Do I have enough room? Remember what I said last time. Two decimal places. If it's an if it's a percentage, two decimal places after you've gotten the percentage. 2.04 was the yield. You're saying, well, that kind of sucks. Well, no, the government is very low risk. I mean, the government will pay you back, even if they have to invade another country. They'll get the money. You think I'm joking? That's exactly why we assume they're riskless. The government will get its money. If it borrows it from the Chinese, if it attacks a country, or if it essentially confiscates your sorry land. Okay, well, it worked out for you. That was okay. So a year later, you've gotten your $1,000. You figure, well, this is pretty cool. I'll do this again. So you come to the next auction. And you're kicking the tires and all this kind of stuff. Yep, that's a good one right there. So you take one of the T-bills off the table and you bring it over to me. It's Mabel. I'm Mabel. And you remember me from last time. Well, there you are again. My goodness, you just get better and better as the years go on. Yes, indeed. If I weren't married by God, I got a sister. She's a little older than me, but she's damn young for 80. Phil, how much are T-bills going for? And you say, wait a minute. I'm looking around this room. I don't see a whole lot of people wanting these T-bills today. Gee, I mean, there's no one here lending the government money. What's that going to do to the price of T-bills? Uh-huh. No one wants them, so, well, you're kind of right. I guess we were going to put a sale on T-bills today. You know, maybe buy one, get one free or something like that. I don't know. Okay, Phil, he's being a hard ass. Phil says 950, so we're going to do 950 on you. Would you like a bag for that? Good boy. Thank you. So a year later, what's the face? 1,000. I'm going to come to your dorm room and wake you up in the middle of the night and ask you what's the face value of a bond. You damn well better give me the right answer. Yeah, wouldn't that be a trip? Wake up in the middle of the night, see my sorry ass. What's the interest this time in dollars? How much interest did you get this time? $50. Because you lent the government $950, you got back $1,000, so it's $50. Okay, so now we're going to calculate the yield again. The interest in dollars this time is 50. What's in the denominator? Thank you. It makes my heart warm and my bowels move. Survey says 5.26%. There you go. Your first essential principle of finance is sitting there looking at you. And now I'm going to see if you can state it for me. You, madam. Madam, what did you notice about that light came on again? What happens to yield as price goes down? Yeah, well, anyone. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, this is a rises.
Why?
So no. Well, you don't have to know why. You know what the answer is to why? Because. It's just a mathematical principle. It's not finance. This is one of the weird things when I, in finance and in MQM and in economics classes that I teach, there are these things that are, you think, well, this is all about economics or finance or MQM. No, these are actually just math principles. It's just, it's not really finance at all. It's just as the price goes down, the yield goes up. In finance, for any financial instrument, all other things being equal, price and yield are inversely related. Price and yield are inversely related. So as the price goes down, the yield will go up. As the price goes up, the yield will go... There. I like whiteboards better, as you might be able to tell. But the essentialness of that rule can't be overstated. And this pervades finance. Think about when I was talking about that right there. At a treasury auction, if the global borrowers, the surplus economic units, decide that they don't want to come to that treasury auction, that means that the price of the treasury instruments will fall. And as the price falls, the yield rises. That is what will induce the surplus units to then step up to the plate. They will just let the price fall and fall. In other words, make the yield go up and up until it is high enough for them to step up to the plate and lend the government money. That's how it works. This is the danger that comes at some point in the cycle. The stories go that there have been several of these treasury auctions where they were offering a combo of notes and bills and bonds, and the usual lenders didn't show up. The Chinese, the Arabs, the Germans, and those kinds of hotshots just didn't show up. And so the prices went south, and the yields went like that. And then, of course, the Federal Reserve pisses all over itself because it can't have interest rates going up because that'll kill the economic recovery. So the Federal Reserve, our central bank, comes in and buys the Treasury instruments itself in order to fill in the breach, in order to create that surge of demand to wipe up the supply, push the prices back up and the yields back down so that they're more in line with what the Federal Reserve wants a prevailing interest rate environment to be to stimulate the economy. Now, embedded in there is a rather disturbing thing. You know where the Fed gets the money to go to the auctions to lend to the government? You know where it gets that money? Yeah, it prints it. Wouldn't that be a sweet? I mean, that I've been thinking of trying it myself, but they told me I'd be some hard-timer's old lady if I did. So the government prints money to go to the auctions to borrow. But here's an interesting thing. The Federal Reserve is a central bank. It's actually part of the United States government. It's semi-autonomous, but it's part of it. Now, I'm going to see, let me see who's literate here. Oh, you're all literate. Woman, at the top of this, tell me what it says at the top of that.
Federal Reserve Note.
Federal Reserve Note. Wait, did I use the word note earlier? This is a debt instrument. So the Treasury lends the government money by issuing an intermediate term IOU. Who does it owe that IOU to? It doesn't say. So I don't think it's you. Why do they call it a note? Because one of these animals has a life of about 5 years. You know, then they take them and they grind them up and send them back again. But you see, there's something kind of odd about the system. I don't want to turn you into conspiracy theorists. Well, yes, I do, but the Federal Reserve goes to the auctions and it buys the borrowing of the government to keep the price high by keeping the demand strong. That keeps the yields low on the instruments to allow the economic recovery to keep going. But where does the Fed get the money to do this? It actually just prints the money. It is the issuer. The Federal Reserve is the issuer of an intermediate term debt instrument that it uses the proceeds from to go to the auctions to buy the debt that the government is issuing. Now, if you're saying to yourself, wait, what? That's good. That's the right question to ask. So have you heard of the term QE2 or quantitative easing? What they're doing, the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing? Well, that's one of the ways that it's doing it, is it's printing money to provide to the government that the government can then spend above what it gets in tax revenues. It's a kind of a complicated system, but somehow it's working, so, you know, what the hell. But I keep using this term, interest rate. Now, the problem is that you know as well as I do that there is not just the interest rate out there. You have seen an interest rate that I calculated on a treasury bill. I threw out an interest rate called a coupon rate on a corporate bond. You see, I tossed out an interest rate or two on mortgage loans. You see all kinds of interest rates out there. There is not the interest rate. There is an interest rate that is for a specific instrument at a specific point in time. But there is not the interest rate. Underneath, well, why would there be all of these different interest rates and how are they all related? You start with the fundamental underlying interest rate, which we I gotta watch this. Anymore, finance textbooks use K. We used to use R's all the time. So if you see me drift into R's, just point out to me. But K's are what we use now. There is a fundamental substrate interest rate. It's a theoretical animal that we would not see ever because it always has a haze around it. It has other things that are always going to be on it. We know it's there. It's not just a theoretical construct. I use that word, that term a little bit loosely. It is an actual animal, but we just won't ever see it because it always has something attached to it. But this underlying animal is called the real interest rate. It is the pure opportunity cost of foregone consumption. It is the pure opportunity cost of foregone consumption. At the end of the day, if you lend me $100 for a year, that's $100 you don't have for cheeseburgers today. Which means that you, in order for you to get to do this, to be induced to become a surplus economic unit available to the financial intermediaries, there has to be a positive reward to you. There has to be. That's this animal right here. We can't necessarily, we won't see it. What influences this? The supply of and demand for money. At the core level, the supply of money is driven by factors, most importantly in the short term, by the Federal Reserve. expanding the money supply, contracting the money supply. The demand for money is driven by perhaps somewhat more complex forces. You see, we are the demanders of money. In our individual lives and in our households and in our businesses. But the forces that construct our demand from day to day, week to week, month to month, year to year, can change. Think about it this way. If times are bad, if I were really worried about, say, the banking system, or I was really worried about my own financial situation, I would probably put a lot more cash into my pocket, keep more of my money right with me. So my demand for liquid cash would be high. In better times, I could just go to the ATM and get my money. You know, I might put more money into CDs. If times are good and I believe that I'm going to have lots of money, I will keep my job and I'll have great paychecks every month. You see, that's what those forces that drive the demand are actually something that we really are interested in. We have to look very carefully at what people and businesses, households and industries are doing in terms of their sentiments. And unfortunately, as much as I don't like to talk about feelings and beliefs, really at the end of the day, the demand for money is driven by sentiment, concern, risk aversion, and all of that. So this real interest rate is the confluence of the supply of money and the demand for money. Now, you'll notice that I drew the supply curve as perfectly inelastic. That's how we will do it most of the time, because at any given point in time, the amount of money is just a fixed amount out there. The Fed shifts back and forth through policies like open market operations, activities like open market operations. But those two coming together establish, there I did it again, the real interest rate, the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. But as I said, you would never see a real interest rate. You never would. What you would see is that real interest rate with an expectation on it. The expected amount of erosion that value will suffer. In other words, an expected inflation premium. It is not the inflation premium, it is the expected inflation premium. It is what we in our lending, banks and others in their lending, expect inflation to be. Not what it has been, but what we expect it to be. And that is the dangerous part right there. Because if the government creates an expectation of inflation by having bad inflations year over year, then even if the government finds, reforms itself, finds the Lord and all that, the expectation can still stay there. So that the Fed would have to hold the money supply down for longer than necessary just to get people to stop expecting the inflation. Think of it this way. I'm your boss at work and you're coming to me for an increase in your wage, your pay wage. And I said, all right, you're making $100 a week, and you should be damn well happy about that. But I know, the Fed, the inflation's been running about 4%. So I'm going to give you a 4% raise. Now, suppose in reality, 3 years ago, inflation was 1%. 2 years ago, inflation was 2%. Last year, it was 4%. Are you going to expect inflation to be 4% going forward from this time? No. You will expect inflation to be higher. After a few years, inflation rate for last year was 10%. You come in and you say, I don't want any 4%, 8%. I don't even want 10%. I want 12%. And I'll say to you, don't worry about it. I just saw on the news the Federal Reserve Chairman, that nice guy, Alan Greenspan, or Ben Bernanke now, he says that they've got it under control and inflation will go down next year. So, there you go. Is that going to be enough to make you happy? Oh, hell no. That guy's a lying mofo. Ben Bernanke, Uncle Ben. Hey, whether or not he is, you can't base your economic decision-making. A bank can't base its economic decision-making on what the past told them. It has to be about the future, expectations. That's why the next interest rate premium is what we call the expected inflation premium, which you'll see me draw as a pie with a superscript E. You put those two together and you get the first interest rate we have even a prayer of actually seeing. It's called, there I wrote an R again, the risk-free rate, K sub F. The risk-free rate, K sub F. Now, we don't see this one because it is built from somewhat theoretical constructs. We don't see the real interest rate. We don't know exactly what the expectation of inflation is. So we wouldn't ever actually see K sub F, this risk-free rate. But we do have a very good proxy for it. It's the rate on a short-term T-bill. So in any formula that I give you where we would use the risk-free rate for calculating something tangible, I will tell you a Treasury bill yield. That will be as good as you can, close as you can come to a pure risk-free rate. We use them all the time in theoretical research, the risk-free rate. We proxy it with a short-term T-bill, and there's that blue light on again. Now, from there, we have to talk about what creates other interest rates. This is the first interest rate we would see at least a version of out there in the real world. We would look at short-term T-bills, and that would be about the risk-free rate. But then we have to talk about something we call risk structure, because not every instrument is going to be risk-free. God knows anyone who's lent me money knows it wasn't risk-free. So we have to talk about what forces can create risk that has to be put in. The first of them is almost obvious. It's the default premium. The default premium. The reward for the possibility that part or all of the instrument's obligation won't be satisfied. The reward for bearing the risk that part or all of the obligation won't be satisfied. The default premium. So, for example, the default premium on a mortgage loan, a home mortgage loan, actually is quite low. For at least three reasons. One is there's a hard asset underlying the loan. That's the mortgage instrument. And also, two, many of these loans are guaranteed, like FHA and VA loans. And three, the one that no one talks about, is that almost all loans over 80% loan to value, you as the borrower are paying an insurance premium to a mortgage assurance company every month as part of your payment. One of the big ones is called Magic. So the Magic will make up the difference if the loan goes Tap City to the bank. Did you know that? You hear about this, all these poor banks are all dying. My God, get with it. Most of those loans were guaranteed and there was insurance being paid by the borrowers before they went belly up. Bull crap on that it's a horrible thing that's happened. The only one who's gotten screwed in it are the people who are out on the street. Okay, there's one. Now here's another one. The maturity premium. Now this is the one that's a real pain in the ass for a mortgage company. It is the risk associated with interest rate fluctuations. As time to maturity gets longer, in other words, as your instrument goes longer, more fluctuations could happen. There's just more chances for interest rates to go up or down. Think about this. I am a lender. I lend you money at 8% for 30 years. Now, what happens if 5 years into the loan, interest rates drop to 5%? What are you going to do? You don't know what you're going to do?
No.
Yeah, you're going to refi. Yeah, I mean, why would you pay me 8% when you can refi at 5%? So you see, if interest rates drop, I as a lender am screwed. But here's the other side of it. Suppose that interest rates on prevailing interest rates for loans like this go from 8% to 14%. I'm the lender. I would really love to have that money back so I could lend it at 14%. Do you think he's going to pay me off? I'm going to call him. You know, I'd really like to have you pay me off because that, you know, you're paying like 8% and I could lend that money out at 14%. Is he going to do that? Absolutely not. So you see, I'm screwed both ways. Either way interest rates swing, I get hit. So as a loan gets longer in maturity, I have to put more of a premium on. And the last one here is the reward if I can't sell the loan to someone else. That really isn't much of a problem anymore. It's called the illiquidity premium. You don't see much of that because almost anything that walks and talks can be sold to a secondary market. But it's there. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.